ready to hear argument in 040016 Michiana Easy Living Country, Inc. v. James Holton.
May it please the court, Mr. Kelly Cohen will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. I would like to start off by reading to you a passage that was offered by a court that touches upon a case that is almost identical in the facts that we have here today. The court stated that in the instant case, the contacts of a non-resident defendant with Texas are minimal and fortuitous, and a non-resident cannot be said to have purposefully conducted activities within the state. The non-resident's contacts with Texas were not grounded on any expectation or necessity of invoking the benefits or protections of Texas law, nor were they designed to result in profit from a business transaction undertaken in Texas. The contract was solicited, negotiated, and consummated in another state, and a non-resident did nothing to indicate or to support an inference of any purpose to exercise the privilege of doing business in Texas. Simply put, this court stated that the non-resident was a passive participant in a commercial transaction with a Texas resident. The non-resident neither sought, initiated, nor profited from his single and fortuitous contact with Texas. That was this court's opinion in U Anchor Advertising versus Burke. That is exactly the question we have before us today. This is a case about a non-resident defendant who was contacted by a Texas resident. The contract was negotiated, performed, and completed in Indiana. The product was shipped from Indiana by a third party who was paid for by the respondent. The First Court of Appeals looked at this issue. The First Court of Appeals held that because there was an implied finding of fact, that there was no necessity to look at the quality and nature of the contact, which is not what this court has set down as precedent. This court in BMC Software and Roberson has set down that you do look at the nature and quality of the contacts, and you look at it on a de novo status. You look at what the activities of the defendant were present in order to establish specific jurisdiction.
When there's no record, how do we know that there wasn't additional evidence presented to the trial?
Well, there is the clerk's record in this case, and it is before the court. And in the clerk's record, it has the contract, which states quite plainly.
No, but how do we know that there wasn't? There could have been. I mean, theoretically, they could have come in and put on witnesses and said, "Oh no, this company did this, this, and this, and this in Texas," and we don't have a record. So how do we know what evidence was put on in front of the trial court?
Well, there was no evidence put on in front of the trial court that says there were sufficient contacts to establish general jurisdiction.
But we don't. How do we know that if we don't have the record? That's my question.
Well, respondent has ample opportunity to have presented that at the trial court level, and they did not.
We don't have a record of what was in front of the trial court. That's my question. How do we know what evidence was put in front of the trial court since we don't have a record of the evidence put in front of the
court? We don't have a transcript, so we don't know what the specific language was. But we do have the motions and the pleadings. This particular court the Beaumont Court of Appeals stated in Ravery, which was also quoting the Tyler Court of Appeals in Alliance, stated that when you are reviewing a special appearance, you look to everything that went before the trial court, including pleadings, motions, exhibits, as well as discovery, which was filed in the case, which we do have. Mr. Holton testified in his deposition that he doesn't recall whether he specifically said, "I want these features on this motorhome." What he does testify about is he had a brochure from Coachman, who was the manufacturer. And he believes he got it from a dealer here in Texas, and that he called Coachman, asked him to sell him a motorhome, and they said, if you want to buy a motorhome from Coachman without a Texas dealer involved, you have to go to our factory outlet in Indiana.
Why isn't that enough to establish minimum contacts?
Because the contact was originated from the respondent. The respondent said, I want to buy a motorhome from you in Indiana, and originally the respondent said, I will pick it up in Indiana. Ultimately, he changed his mind. He then was required to pay for the freight to ship it to Texas. Under the Business and Commerce Code, the FOB point, which is Indiana in this case, establishes when delivery takes place. The only contact that Michiana has with Texas is a phone call or phone calls which were originated by the respondent. This particular court has held in Guardian Royal Exchange that a unilateral contact initiated by a Texas resident is not sufficient to establish specific jurisdiction. The contact was initiated by Mr. Holton. In his deposition, he testifies that he doesn't recall specifically asking for any single feature, but just said, I want a particular model. And when he gets the model here, it doesn't have what he wants, and he files suit. Now, the sole contact that he's alleging specific jurisdiction arises out of is a phone call in which he claims there were misrepresentations. The First Court of Appeals held that because there was no findings of fact and conclusions of law, that the First Court of Appeals had to assume that that was true. This court has held on numerous occasions that that is not true. You don't just necessarily have to assume that the implied finding of facts and conclusions of law are conclusive. You can look at other things. If we look at other things, meaning the deposition transcripts, the motions that were filed, the clerk's record, we find that there is insufficient evidence to support the claim of specific jurisdiction. This particular court in the U-Anchor Advertising versus Burke case, which is extremely similar, Burke was an Oklahoma resident who was contacted by a Texas resident for the specific purpose of the Texas resident selling him advertising materials which were to be used in Oklahoma.
Was that a contract case?
No, Your Honor. That case was grounded in tort. Oh, I'm sorry. That case was a contract case. I apologize.
So that's, we're here because they're alleging a tort was committed in Texas.
If, yes, Your Honor, the Amarillo Court of Appeals in Lakin versus McFaul, which was a tort case.
Which what?
Which was a tort case, which issued an opinion consistent with this court's opinion in U-Anchor Advertising, basically stated that a single telephone call is not sufficient to establish specific jurisdiction.
But we've got the Memorial Hospital System versus Fisher that says it is.
Yes, Your Honor. The difference between, I think, Memorial Fisher versus the cases that we have here today.
Is Memorial Fisher's right?
No, Your Honor, I'm going to disagree with the Court of Appeals in Memorial Fisher. The reason is because if we accept the principles that are laid down in Memorial Fisher, what we do to the analysis of whether specific jurisdiction should or should not be asserted is to reduce it to a mechanical test. The United States Supreme Court in Hansen versus Dinkla admonished that to do such a thing would be to lower the restrictions of state courts on asserting specific jurisdiction. This court has actually quoted the United States Supreme Court's opinion in Hansen versus Dinkla and stated that we should not reduce the analysis of specific jurisdiction to a mechanical test. If we accept the respondent's argument as true, that is exactly what we are doing. We are saying that if a phone call is made and a tort arises out of that phone call, specific jurisdiction is automatically established. We do not pay attention to the analysis of the nature and the quality of the defendant's actions. When we pay attention to the nature and the quality of the defendant's actions in the analysis under the framework established for asserting specific jurisdiction, what we find is that Michiana, the petitioner in this case, never purposefully availed themselves of the benefits and the protections of the laws of the state of Texas, which is a critical element in order to establish specific jurisdiction. Michiana merely picked up a telephone, answered a question, and filled an order, which was done in Indiana, delivery was completed in Indiana, payment was made in Indiana. The only contact we have here is a phone call.
Then they received some benefit from that phone call.
They did, Your Honor. But if we accept that argument as true and we take it not to the logical extreme, but even halfway to the logical extreme, we reduce the analysis of whether specific jurisdiction should be asserted to a mechanical test. Because if we accept that argument, any website anywhere in the world that is clicked on by a Texas resident and a transaction of a commercial nature results, there's specific jurisdiction. That does eliminate the boundaries that are placed by the Constitution on whether a party can be expected to be held in a particular state court.
Was there any oral testimony at the trial court hearing?
There was not any oral testimony at the trial court hearing.
So.
But we do have Mr. Holton's deposition, which is.
Is there anything that may have happened at the trial court hearing that we don't have in our record?
The only factual issue that is in dispute, as far as I can tell, is whether there was a misrepresentation made in a phone call. There is no dispute that Michiana is an Indiana corporation, that they've never done any other business within the state of Texas. There is no dispute that originally Mr. Holton asked for the delivery to take place in Indiana and then subsequently changed his mind, but he paid for the freight by a third party, independent of the petitioner, to deliver the motorhome to Texas. That establishes that the motorhome was delivered in Texas and the contract was the motorhome was delivered in Indiana and the contract was completed in Indiana.
Real quickly, what in the record affirmatively shows that there was no evidence or testimony presented to the trial court?
Well, I'm not sure if you're asking me to prove a negative. If I understand your question, Your Honor.
Is there a stipulation by the parties? Have y'all agreed with that? Is there something in the record that affirmatively shows no evidence was put before the trial court at the hearing? He decided it based on the existing filed documents.
I would assume that there was argument. I don't believe that there was any oral sworn testimony presented. I do believe that the deposition testimony of Mr. Holton was referenced. But as you pointed out, Your Honor, we do not have a reporter's record or a transcript of the actual language which was utilized at the hearing.
Was one even made?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Was one even made?
I believe that one was made, Your Honor. I don't know what the response of the judge was because I was personally not present at that particular hearing. But if we go back to this court's ruling, it is an implied finding of fact. This court reviews it on a de novo standard, particularly when you're applying law. Even if we assume that the implied finding, the fact that there was a misrepresentation, was undisputed, we still look at the other extrinsic evidence that's been presented in this case, which is the motions that were filed, the documents and exhibits which were attached to those motions. And when we do that, we come to the very same conclusion. That is, everything that occurred with regards to this transaction occurred in Indiana except a telephone call. The telephone call was originated by Mr. Holton. The Texas courts have held, albeit there is a difference among appellate courts, but this court has held and issued opinions consistent that a single telephone call or a telephone call originated from a Texas resident is not sufficient to establish specific jurisdiction. You have to look at the nature and quality of the contacts.
There was more than, there was a phone call which led to the transaction. So this is more than just a phone call, right?
You're right, Your Honor. But my contention is the only contact with Texas was via telephone. All the other components of this transaction, which you have to look at in whole, were completed in Indiana.
So does Michiana not sell any products to Texas residents?
Michiana does not actively pursue any Texas residents to sell products to. Mr. Holton contacted the manufacturer, Coachman Industries. Let me back up. Mr. Holton originally contacted a Texas dealer to buy this motorhome. He decided he could get a better price at the factory. Contacted the factory. The factory said, we do not sell directly to the consuming public. You must go through either a Texas dealer or our factory outlet. And they gave Mr. Holton the contact information for Michiana. Mr. Holton then contacted Michiana and said, I want to order a specific motorhome. Mr. Holton cannot recall making any representations as to any specific features that he wanted, which is what he complains of at this time, that there were not specific features that he wanted. The only contact we have is the placing of the order to an Indiana corporation. If we accept the respondent's argument as true, then no commercial transaction can be completed with a Texas resident and a non-resident, which would not confer specific jurisdiction if the Texas resident then complains about the product. I mean, we could have cases where an automobile, such as what was happening in Worldwide Volkswagen, is purchased from an out-of-state corporation. The Texas resident drives a car for 10 years and it breaks down. Then that out-of-state corporation who sold the car could be hailed to defend a case in this state, even though he had never done anything to actively pursue business within Texas. The respondent's argument is there was a telephone call. There was a misrepresentation that is sufficient to establish specific jurisdiction. They also argue that because there's no record, there's an implied finding of fact. saying that the misrepresentation was true, and that since it was true, it establishes specific jurisdiction. This circular argument, Your Honors, establishes that in any commercial transaction, there is specific jurisdiction.
Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Brock Akers will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, Michiana Easy Living accepted $63,000 for this product, specifically ordered, made to order. They required the money ahead of time, and they had it delivered to Jim Holton in Baytown, Texas at 9:30 at night, asked him to sign a receipt, which he did, and then he took the delivery guy to the airport.
Is there evidence of that in the record?
The same sort of evidence that were...
which would be deposition testimony.
It's in the deposition testimony, yes.
Was there any evidence at the hearing?
Yeah, I was there. there were offers of proof. Mr. Holton was present. We talked in detail with the trial judge all about the facts and the circumstances, and we...
But did anybody get on the stand, raise, swear? And
no.
Okay.
What we had instead were offers of proof from counsel as to what the testimony would be, which was accepted by all as being.
And was that the stuff that had previously been filed with the clerk? Have that in the clerk's record?
No, the offers of proof were, essentially oral recitations of what some of these things that I'm spouting out now.
Well, I know, but we usually try not to decide things based on just what the lawyers say. Even such well-known lawyers. We usually like to look at the contracts, we look at the deposition, see what the people under oath said. That stuff was all on file in the clerk's record.
Yes, sir.
Now, what could these folks have done other than refusing to deal with Texans to avoid this suit that they didn't do?
They could have insisted, for instance, that the product be picked up.
Well, now, they did originally, and then your guy said, no, that's inconvenient for me. Would you deliver it to a third party who will drive it down here? And they acceded. So they should have told your client, nope, you got to come up here and get it. And then that would have been different.
Well, they charged him for a substantial amount of money to deliver it to Texas.
Well, so that tends to show they didn't purposely avail themselves of Texas, but they made him pay for it to get it here, right?
One of the portions of their contract, which they want to rely upon now as evidence, the conclusive proof of reliance, is the notion that it was... matters were gone over with a dealer representative, with either the manufacturer or the dealer's representative, so that he was fully satisfied what they did by entrusting this delivery person with those responsibilities, at least for the paperwork and the delivery, was essentially to appoint this agent to come to Texas and deliver this product to Baytown, Texas. And that surely is a substantive contact with Texas. They knew when they took that order that this was going to be coming down here. They required money ahead of time before they even
Troubling thing here is, take two other states. You're sitting in your office in Florida. And somebody calls you from Alaska and says, please send me this. So you put it in a box and you send it to him. And meanwhile, he hangs up the phone, walks down the street to the courthouse, and says you lied to him. And all of a sudden, all you were doing was responding to a customer, and now you're litigating in Alaska, which you wish you didn't have to do. Isn't there something unfair about it? Being able to hail somebody in to a court simply on your assertion that no more than that occurred?
No, that's not fair. And the reason, they're taking the money. They have no problem taking the Texan's money, and they have no problem dealing with the Texan. And if they don't have any problem dealing with the Texan and taking his money and taking profit from him, knowing that that's who he is, and knowing that they're going to deliver it and do all that sort of thing, then they ought to be subject, when they commit a fraud on that person, to Texas state court.
Let me add to Justice Hecht's hypothetical. He walks into their office in Florida, gives them the money there in Florida, says, ship it to me in Alaska, that's convenient for me, but and signs a form selection clause agreeing to be try everything in Florida. Now, isn't it a little unfair for him to say, King's X, when I signed the form selection clause saying Florida, I had my fingers crossed. Come on up to Alaska. It's nice this time of year.
Well, that's one of those other cases. There's a case in the record much more like your fact situation, the name of which I don't remember, that does not confer jurisdiction under those circumstances. And it's a tighter call. But, of course, that's not what we have here.
How is it different? Just because it was, just because he didn't walk into the office in Florida, he called from Alaska. He still signed a forum selection clause saying Indiana.
Well, I mean, and that's a another issue entirely. I mean, the word waiver hasn't yet passed my lips, but it applies to every argument that we have discussed here today. But as to the forum selection clause under those circumstances, that forum selection clause, to the extent that it applies to the contract itself, may be enforceable. When it is, when you have fraud that is outside of the contract, when you have DTPA-like violations that are outside of the contract, then the forum selection clause ought not apply.
What, it's, it didn't have related to or the sale or anything like that language in it?
In this case, the argument that's been waived?
Yes. And why was it waived? I'm sorry.
It was waived at the trial court. It was waived at the Court of Appeals. It is not part of any of the briefing to this court.
So they...
You mean the form selection?
Form selection.
So they, of course, I mean, the contract's in evidence with the forum selection clause, but they waived it because we don't have the oral argument hearing transcript where they might have said something about it.
Well, that's, yeah,
that's
yes, I mean, that's part of it.
I understand.
Setting aside the delivery person issue for the moment, what if this had been... same facts, except that the, he picked up the phone and ordered a wine press from France.
Wine boycotting France. wine press from France, and do the French, are they exposed to a Texas court? If... well, an ocean, I don't think, makes a difference that I can think of. It's the same sort of circumstance if we're putting it into the same sort of factual scenario.
Well, do we have any evidence? I assume the – do we have any evidence whether Michiani's RVs end up everywhere in the United States? I imagine wine presses don't end up that many places in the U.S. Do we know whether – sure, Coachman's all over, but how about Michiana? Do we know one way or the other?
We know only from the record that when you call Coachman in order to deal directly with them, they report that this is our local dealer with whom you can deal. And that is how Mr. Holton found them, is that because of the symbiotic relationship between Coachman and Michiana, and which has not been fully explored in the record below despite all these years between us, that they direct them automatically to Michiana with the representation that they were their, essentially their factory outlet.
Where in Texas did this tort occur?
Baytown.
That was the consequence of the phone call?
Yes. Mr. Holden lives in Baytown.
Was it the consequence of the phone call and the receipt that he signed when it was delivered, or just a consequence
the tort?
Of the phone call?
Yes. No, the tort comes from the misrepresentations that flow from, this is what you're going to get. You're going to get a coach with this feature, and when he gets them and he's able to look at it in the light, it doesn't have any of those features. And then some of them don't work. Pure misrepresentation.
Did they try to remedy that situation?
No, they refused to.
If they would have tried to remedy that situation, right, there would have been a little easier to establish minimum contacts?
Yes. I mean, what happened to Mr. Holton is that he said, hey, what's the phone? What's the deal here? So, oh, take it to your local dealer. The local dealer said, oh, I can't work on this. You need to take it back to Indiana.
The dealers in Texas sell those products?
There are. If Coachman products.
Of course.
They would have purchased a product from the dealer, and the dealer would have delivered a product that your client didn't order. Would that be sufficient to establish minimum contacts?
I believe so.
Of course, the reason we're here is because your client didn't want to deal with somebody local. He thought he could get a better deal, and the reason it's cheaper in Michigan is because if you want to return it, they're in Michigan or Indiana or wherever, right? So isn't your client trying to have his cake and eat it too? I want to save some money by dealing directly with the factory outlet, but I'm complaining that now I've got to return all the stuff up there. I mean, that was the deal, right?
Well,
he could have bought it from Coachman, and then everything, he could have driven it across town to get it fixed.
Well, no, sir. The Coachman said, we will not sell it to you directly. You have to go to our local factory outlet. He could have bought it from a more local dealer and paid a premium for that. And he absolutely was trying to save money by dealing directly with the factory. And then after negotiating the price...
Well, isn't that the unfairness? You say, I want it cheaper, so I'm going to go out of state, and then when you get something you don't like, you say, oh, no, it was all down here. That's where I'm having trouble. Seems like when you take that chance, then the chances are you're dealing with somebody farther away. Isn't that the difference between local dealers and out-of-state ones?
Well, I mean, if there were no dealers in Texas.
Different situation. That's not our situation.
It's not our situation. Is it wrong for him to have dealings with an out-of-state people? Of course not. Is it wrong for him to expect them to not tort him and commit a fraud upon him? Of course not. Is it fair in Acres' mind for these people who getting a profit and are willing to sell it to him and know where it's going and are charging him for the delivery, for them to expect after they've committed a fraud on him and then think that he's so far away that he's never going to come back and bite him? No, I don't think that's fair, because that's exactly what happened here. It's the flip side of what's fair. It's they say, we're so far away, you can't get us.
Mr. Acres, did I hear you to effectively concede earlier that there was no evidence presented to the trial court that would impact our resolution of this case?
No, I don't concede that at all.
But you were present. I mean, and there were offers of proof, but I thought you said earlier there was no testimony, that the record essentially is the depositions and affidavits that were before the trial court. That's the same record that we have here.
Yeah, I mean, the record for the court to consider. I mean, you can't take my word for it. I'm being honest with you, I really. But you can't just take that. That's why we have these rules relating to findings of fact, conclusions of law, and reporter's records. You have to give presumptions to the trial court. The trial court is entitled to having these presumptions.
Yeah, but we don't require a reporter's record if nothing happened other than
Well, but it was more than lawyer talk.
Well, that's what we're asking.
Yeah. I mean, it was essentially an offer of proof. My witness, much as you would in a bill of exception, my witness, if called, would say XYZ123.
That's not evidence.
Are you saying
I believe it is.
Are you saying it was tried on stipulated evidence?
The trial court was given the facts. These weren't stipulated facts per se. But he essentially asked us, what's the deal here? He asked us questions about this.
Right, but that happens in all summary judgment hearings. And the fact of the matter is, nothing can happen at a summary judgment hearing other than what you attach to your affidavits. But the summary judgment hearing, you say, well, what mine says is this, what mine says is that. But we limit our review to what you filed with the clerk. Is what you all talked about stuff that was filed with the clerk or something else?
No, it was not. I believe that it falls more in the form, and this isn't a summary judgment hearing. You don't take testimony at a summary judgment hearing. You do take testimony at a special appearance hearing.
Right. We used to do only by testimony, but we changed that rule because it didn't make sense for people out of state to have to come in and orally testify that they shouldn't be hailed into the state, and so we now encourage people to do it all by affidavits. And we don't want to set up a presumption rule that requires them to go back and do it the old way, that everybody has to come in live and say why they shouldn't have to come in live in Texas. And so that's why I'm asking, are you wanting us to presume that there was something that happened at the hearing that's not going to be found and can't be found in the clerk's record?
Yes. The offers of proof, which Justice Owen disagrees with me as to whether or not that constitutes evidence for the trial court's consideration. The trial court heard what the witness sitting, you know, right over there, what he would say if we took the time to swear him in. Those sorts of offers of proof are the sorts of things upon which a trial court under these circumstances ought to be permitted to rely.
Was that testimony, had it been committed to deposition testimony before, or was this going to be, was what your so-called offer of proof different from what was in the depositions?
I can't tell you that, I remember.
If I'm in California and I click on the internet and I see a product that I like, whether it's a big trailer that costs $63,000 or a $5 product, and I ask that product to be delivered to Texas, and I get to Texas, to my home, it's not what I ordered. Have I established minimum contacts for Texas?
there's a body of law, as I understand it, that relates to these internet cases that I'm shamefully not familiar with.
Well, I don't know about the facts in your case. I'm just trying to get a clarification on minimum contacts concept.
I think that the character of this contact was substantially different. It was a negotiating process. It was an ordering. This is what you can get if you want it. It was going over a whole list of things. It was arranging for financing. It was ultimately arranging for delivery. It was a whole series of transactions, which all of which told this seller that this sale and the profit from that sale was going to come from the money of some Texan, and that it was going to be used in Texas, and that this product that we were specially making for him was ultimately going to be going there.
What is the record evidence about the delivery person and what transpired in Texas?
Well, the only record evidence would come out of this the time.
Whose agent was he? You said earlier that they were now saying in the brief that he was their agent. What is the evidence on the agency part of the delivery person?
Therein would be one of those things that I think that the court should presume as to the trial court's evidence. This person came, delivered the unit directly from the manufacturer. He was the person that required Mr. Holton to sign and then ultimately disclaim also on this issue. And as such, if you are going to look at the very contract which was signed that talks about dealer or dealer's representative, that person who presented it and presented those papers to him, either he was that person, he had to have been that person, or well, he had to be that person. They just can't have it both ways.
Any further questions? Thank you.
I'd like to pick back up with the hypothetical Justice Heck put forward, and that was if a person is in Alaska, calls a Florida company, and has it shipped, does it establish specific jurisdiction? I'd like to take it one step further. It's a Texas resident that calls a Florida company, and the Texas resident says, ship it to Alaska. Does that confer specific jurisdiction in Texas? Because the contract's with a Texas resident. The phone call originated from Texas. But the seller on the other end of the phone had no idea. Unless he maybe had caller ID or could, you know, divine it from
somewhere. Just worry about that one when that one happens. What about the record here? I mean, it is true. Normally, if it's an evidentiary hearing, we presume things happen, even if we're making them up, that supported the verdict. Was this an evidentiary hearing? How do we? What happened to these offers of proof? Do we have depositions? If so, how'd they get to us?
We have the deposition of Mr. Holton. That's the only deposition testimony I'm aware of, Justice Frister. But I think you hit the key element, and that is what did happen. That Michiana, the petitioner, submitted affidavits basically setting out the specific proof necessary to negate the basis for specific jurisdiction. Michiana is a dealership. They don't produce a product. They are a reseller of Coachman material, which is the same as Holiday World, which is a Texas dealer that sells Coachman.
Were there live witnesses sitting in the courtroom at the hearing?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't catch that.
Were there live witnesses sitting in the courtroom at the hearing?
Just Mr. Holton, as far as I can tell.
Nobody flew down from
Michiana. It was submitted by affidavit. Very reason that Justice Brister pointed out, it seemed a bit patently unfair to require somebody to come to Texas to explain why they shouldn't be in Texas.
But we, again, how do we know what happened at the hearing without a record? I mean, how as a court we can say with confidence there was no stipulation, there was no anything else about evidence?
We can look at the clerk's record in the
but
motions.
But we don't, in other words, what if Mr. Holton was sitting there and Mr. Aker said, I'm going to call him, and the trial court said, now, wait a minute, I don't want to take up your time with counsel. Will you all agree what this guy was going to say? And the answer is yes. That's how do we know that didn't happen? How do we know what happened at the hearing?
Without being flippant, Your Honor, because we're here, if Michiana's counsel had stipulated to the factual assertions of Mr. Holton, there wouldn't be an issue before this court. The factual assertion that is being disputed is whether or not there was a sufficient contact with Texas to establish specific jurisdiction over Michiana. Mr. Holton alleges it was a misrepresentation.
What are the facts about the delivery person?
The delivery person was paid for. Let me back up. Mr. Holton was charged to have the motorhome delivered to Texas. That fee was given over to Michiana. Michiana then, in turn, arranged for an independent third party to deliver the motorhome from Coachman's factory to Baytown, Texas, at Mr. Holton's address. And that's what we know. Now, the deposition testimony of Mr. Holton is it arrived at 9:30 at night. There was an inspection sheet, basically, which you would normally find on an item that has lots of components that says, you as the customer, look it over. If you notice any defects, you need to note it on this inspection sheet. Mr. Holton basically put a disclaimer at the top that says, you know, I'll sign this, but subject to my subsequent inspection. And that's not what we're taking issue with in this case. You know, what we're taking issue with factually is whether or not there was a misrepresentation, because that's the single point.
I'm trying to get at what is there any presumptions in favor of the trial court's conclusion that delivery person was Michiana's agent?
No, Your Honor. There is nothing to suggest that. The only evidence we have on that particular issue is the fact that the contract between Michiana and Mr. Holton states that he, Mr. Holton, would have to pay for freight. That's an undisputed fact. If we look to the law of Texas and basically look to the UCC in general, when that situation occurs, the FOB point is the origin point for lack of a better word. And that at the origin point is when delivery takes place and when the risk of loss is considered done. The one question I would like to put forth before this court is the basis for specific jurisdiction is very tenuous as asserted by Mr. Holton. I don't know if tort reform has become so successful in the state that we have to stimulate litigation by allowing plaintiffs to make a phone call and then in some form or fashion contrive a cause of action which actually confers specific jurisdiction.
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and that is oral arguments for this cause and for the morning, and the clerk will now adjourn.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas.